Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Hey, everybody. I was excited to see earlier this week, right after we finished the show on Sunday, actually, that actor Daniel Kaluuya won a Golden Globe Award for his role portraying Fred Hampton, the chair of the Illinois Black Panther Party, in the film Judas and the Black Messiah. It's a cool film, and it just so happens that I recently had the pleasure of interviewing Daniel about this very role. The interview aired as a segment on the New Yorker Radio Hour, which is also a great show, and we've partnered up with them a few times in the past. And I really want to share a version of it with all of you as well. Now, obviously, you haven't heard many celebrity interviews on our show. You're more likely to meet an activist or a historian. But in this case, it's a really neat overlap because the movie is itself a history of this consequential life, this barely adult activist who gave literally everything to the struggle for racial equity. And actually, here's something Daniel said about that in his Golden Globe acceptance speech.
Man, this took it out of me. I gave everything. Like the great Nipsey Hussle says, we're here to give till we're empty. And I gave everything. And I couldn't give it to a more noble man. And that's Chairman Fred Hampton. And I hope generations after this can see how brilliant he thought, how brilliantly he spoke, and how brilliantly he loved. And he taught me about myself and made me grow as a man. And I appreciate it with all my heart. And I hope people, there's a lot of information about how he died, but I hope you people out there will grow and learn about how incredibly he lived.
So Daniel and I talked a lot about Fred Hampton and the Panthers, but we also talked about his overall career as an actor, as a black man trying to carve out his own artistic path. I hope you enjoy it. When did you realize you wanted to be a storyteller and an actor?
My teachers used to tell my mom like he should get into acting. And I realized back in the day, like my mom actually told another mom. She said like yeah, she got me into that to get me off the streets, essentially. It was, you know, you could get sucked into a couple energies, you know. So on Fridays and the Saturdays and the Sundays, I was just doing something, you know. And because it was improvisation, you know, it was really scary at the beginning as a 13-year-old doing it. And then I found that you could have a career of it. There was people in my class that were on TV. Not in my class. There was people in the more advanced classes that were on TV. And I'd see them and I was, wow, like, you're on TV. Like, is it possible? like I think improv is, what I say is improv is a creative art and acting is an interpretive art. So there's something about improv is like inherently satisfying. Essentially, so you're just creating something out of nothing, and when it hits, you know, and I would just really challenge myself and always would do something different every week. I didn't really look at a script for the first 3 years of me doing acting, like, so when people gave me words, I was like, what, are you going to tell me what to say? It's amazing.
And did you ever return to writing, you know, writing plays and whatnot?
I got back into the writing when I was 16, writing plays, but I never used to write them down. I used to like tell people like, yo, do this, do that. From there, I was formulating ideas in that way. I realized that this was my thing, and then Skins happened, and then we was rolling.
Right. Skins ran for some years on British TV, but it was at least a decade before you had a lead in a big Hollywood film, which was Jordan Peele's Get Out. And I don't know if you understand just how much that shook so many of us here in the U.S., like how much your performance grabbed people like me. How'd you come to that role?
It's funny because it's like I was in a really, when it started, I was in a bad spot in my life. I've got a lot of rejection of the color of my skin. You know what I'm saying? I would get roles and then execs would come in and say, no black leads. So I was in a weird position where I felt like I'd done the time. I realized it wasn't meritocracy. know what I'm saying? This industry. It wasn't I was pissed that it wasn't a meritocracy. It was I was annoyed that I believed in it. You know what I'm saying? Like, I was like, man, I believed them. They told me something and I believed them. And so I didn't act for a year and a half and I just dipped out and I was just like, yo, let me take time. Like, let me just like figure out who I am. Like, why am I doing this? Why do I act?
Well, I mean, certainly it was just the beginning of an eruption of essential performances from you. So, you know, you play in Black Panther in 2018, and then later that year, you're in Widows by Steve McQueen. And then you follow that up with a lead role in the film Queen and Slim.
Queen and Slim. That was really challenging because it was like, I felt like you don't rarely see characters like that in narratives because he's content. He doesn't want more than what he has. Do you know what I'm saying? He wants like a lady to share that with, but that's it. And I realized that was a real challenge for me because possibly I wasn't content and I wanted more than what I have. But what's that communicating about me to me? It's like going, oh, like, Dan, you're not, you're always, you don't like yourself or you don't feel you're enough. You feel me? Like Slim thinks he's enough. His life is enough. I think that's a beautiful thing to say. And you don't really see Black people go, yeah, I'm good.
Well, that feels like a great transition to talking about Deputy Chairman Fred Hampton in Judas and the Black Messiah. I wonder, before you read the script, what did you know about the Black Panther Party? Like, what did you bring into this in terms of that history?
I knew just not, I wasn't taught a lot in school at school about it. Very minimal. It was like a passing comment. Then, yeah, I kind of just was taking stuff in naturally, just like dealing with the frustrations of being a young Black man in a white country, like, and actually caring deeply about self-empowerment. And I would just be gravitating towards the Black Panther Party's ideologies and philosophies and concepts. And
if back then, before you made the film, before you started studying, if somebody had asked you, you know, to describe the Black Panther Party, how would you have described it?
People who were uncompromising about protecting themselves. Is how I would have described it before.
And did you know about the history of the FBI's role in trying to dismantle the Panthers? Were you familiar with that history as well?
I was aware of the Black Messiah mandate agenda. I was aware of that. And I don't know when that came to me, but I remember going, what the? They did what? They tried to do what? I remember that going, whoa, this is...
What about Fred Hampton himself? I mean, you know, I have to say, I imagine any time an actor steps forward to play a notable person like this, it's got to be complicated, right? Because we're all watching and we already have all these ideas about this person. And in this case, somebody like Fred Hampton, I mean, he really means something quite deep and emotional to many of us. To me, he's literally a martyr in the struggle for my own personal freedom. That's how I see him. So I just wonder how you mentally, how you physically would prepare or did prepare for a role like that.
It's a lot, bro. It's a lot. I went Shaka King, the director, amazing director. I asked him about the Black Panther reading list. So in order to be a fully fledged Panther, you need to go on 6 weeks of political education. So I said, what's the reading list? So he sent me the reading list and I just started reading, you know, I started reading the books and I just saw it as like, I needed to get into before I started looking at Chairman Fred, I needed to get into the mindset and the idea, what they were talking about, you know, and getting into it from late 60s point of view, as opposed to a 2018, 2019 point of view.
Because we've grown so accustomed to being poor, we think it's normal for our kids to go to school hungry. We think it's normal for us to go to the hospital with a runny nose and come home with a body bag. So our job, as a Black Panther Party, is to heighten the contradictions.
I pledge allegiance to my black people.
You know, one of my favorite scenes in Judas and the Black Messiah, it might be when Deborah Johnson, who's Fred Hampton's partner, played by Dominique Fishback, she catches you listening to a speech, and I think it was Malcolm X, and you're kind of mimicking him, like a kid lip-syncing to a pop song almost. And I got to say, I was really sort of taken back to my own teenage years there, listening to recordings of Louis Farrakhan and trying to sort of mimic his voice myself. And it struck me that you were performing a performer in some ways who did not consider himself a performer, right?
No, I didn't see it as a performance. I think if I saw it at a performance, then I'm engaged with ego, like Chairman Fred's ego. I think he's a student. You know, and like understanding that he really, really did listen to Malcolm X speeches and Martin Luther King speeches in order to build his skill set of public speaking. But it's that kind of like I don't feel like it would have served me to see him as a performer, because it was very real to him. His want and desire for people to awaken for themselves manifested with those speeches and the way that he told those speeches.
I don't believe I'm gonna die, no Corey. I don't believe I'm gonna die slipping on no ice. I don't believe I'm gonna die because I got a bad heart. I believe I'm gonna die doing what I was born for. I believe I'm gonna die half the people. I'm gonna die for the people because I live for the people. I live for the people because I love the people.
I think it was so important to see him as a human being, you know. Everyone calls him an icon and this and that, you know, and he is that. But he's an icon because he's a human being, and because he's a human being that loved deeply and he loved black people deeply. That's why he's an icon. And to have access, it goes, yeah, he was 20, 21.
21 years old. It's one of the things that just keeps sticking out to me. They were so young. They were babies doing these remarkable things. I want to ask you about a scene that doesn't include your character, but I think is really important. It's because it shows the differences between someone like Fred Hampton and Bill O'Neill, who was the FBI's informant, played by Lakeith Stanfield. The two men, of course, could not be further apart in terms of how they lived, how they viewed the world. And while watching this scene, I wondered how Hampton would have responded to the FBI agent, Roy Mitchell. He's played by Jesse Plemons. And here, the agent explains the purpose of their work to the informant. So let's listen to that.
Don't let Hampton fool you. The Panthers and the Klan are one and the same. Their aim is to sow hatred and inspire terror. Plain and simple. Now, I'm all for civil rights, but you can't cheat your way to equality. And you certainly can't shoot your way to it.
That, for me, that line is there. It's like seeing the radicalness of their perspective on things. You know what I'm saying? And how they present it in such a rational way. You know what I'm saying? It's like, oh, the people who lynch black people, the Ku Klux Klan, are the same as people who feed kids. This is what we are engaging with. You know what I'm saying? It's like, and I'm like, I'm saying that one line illuminated so much to me. And I'm like, oh, wow, I didn't see it like that. Like, because you don't hear that point of view. I don't know, but it's like, I think it's important for us to really dissect, like, this is how they see us. The antagonization rooted in white fear and white anxiety, them being named terrorists because they educated kids, because they loved themselves, because they was uncompromising with that.
That was experienced as terrorism by certainly the FBI.
Look at the film. Everyone's looking at O'Neill, but O'Neill was activated by the FBI. Let's not sleep. You know what I'm saying? Let's not sleep. He was a 19-year-old kid put in a situation by men. And they said, you either go in prison or you're doing this.
But let me ask you this about O'Neill, because I've also heard Shaka King, the writer and director, say, you know, he wanted viewers to wrestle with where we each fit in the spectrum between these two people, Fred Hampton and Bill O'Neill, you know, this, the communitarian versus the individualist, the socialist versus the capitalist, this brave Hampton versus a terrified Bill O'Neill. And I wonder then for yourself, as you were making this film, you know, if Shaka King wanted us to wrestle with that as individuals, did you have occasion to wrestle with that with yourself?
Removed from the film, I can really see O'Neill's position and see the dangers of apathy, you know, the dangers of indifference. You think you're preserving yourself, but you are destroying yourself. I can see that in that, yeah.
You mentioned earlier that you were, earlier in your career, you were upset that you had believed in the idea of meritocracy. And I wonder then, after you have these films, this incredible run of films, where you know you're successful by anybody's measure. I just wonder, Do you reflect back on that moment? How does it change what you do or don't think about the process of getting these roles?
That moment was dark, and it was beautiful. Because I realized, it's like, nah, you just go and get it. I left a mindset of white people need to give me something.
Mm.
No one can give me anything. Like, it's mine. Everything I have is mine.
Mm.
You know what I'm saying? And that's the shift. It was like, oh man, I had a belief in me that betrayed my essence. You feel me? Like, I expect people to give me. I expect, if you do this, you get this, you get this, you get this. I looked at their measurement of who I am. You know what I'm saying? As opposed to just looking at myself and going, who am I?
Mm-hmm.
What do I stand for? What are my feelings telling me about me? You see, I'm acting accordingly. Do you know what I'm saying? That's why it was a beautiful moment, because I was free. Do you know what I'm saying? It's all this stuff, like all these things that they kind of say, yeah, you need to do this, you need to do that, you need to do this. No, you just don't like me like that. Hey, you don't love me like that, is the accurate.
Yeah. I have to ask you also before we go about your next project, or an upcoming project, as I understand it, which at least on the surface sounds to me like quite a departure from all the work we've been talking about. Barney the Dinosaur? I understand you're going to produce a film about Barney. Why Barney?
Why not? The reason why I fell in love with film, because I watch kids' films. You can really allow really credible messages to go through that, because you go to the base and core of storytelling. And what really resonated with me is that Barney said, I love you, you love me, won't you say you love me too? And people hate him. But he never actually taught us, like, what happens if that person doesn't love you back.
Oh, wow.
I just found it really profound.
Is it going to be a feature film or a documentary? And when can we expect to have this?
It's a film and it's being built now. So, you know, and that's all I'm saying, Kai. That's it. You've got a lot already. You've got a lot already, my guy.
That's fair enough. Thank you. Thank you so much for this time.
All right. Take care. Yeah. Thank you so much, guys. Yeah.
I need everybody to repeat after me. I am a revolutionary.
Special thanks to our friends at the New Yorker Radio Hour for this interview, and particularly to Kalalea, who produced the initial version of this conversation. I hope you'll check out the film if you haven't already done so, and if you want to really get your head into what the Black Panthers were trying to achieve, I urge you to check out a book. It's called The Black Panthers: Portraits from an Unfinished Revolution by Brian Shee and Yahuru Williams. The Panthers were more about social service and community building than anything else. That gets lost sometimes in the focus on, you know, their unapologetic self-defense, which is a great thing, and on the dashing young men who stood in the spotlight. In this book, it's a collection of oral histories from the women and the men who were doing that work in the community, and many of whom are still doing it today. So check it out. It's a great read and a really nice pairing with this film. So thanks for listening, and talk to you next episode.
A lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.